Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody's got the fever. This is something we all know. Fever isn't such a new thing. Fever started long ago.
Good evening and welcome to Lenny Godfrey Straight, No Chaser. We have some wonderful guests that we are going to be having a conversation with tonight. I say we, that's because I'm including those of you who have already filled up my board this evening. And those of you, if you're calling in and you can't get through, just keep on trying because I have no more room on my board. So maybe somebody will move around a little bit. But let me just do a bit of housekeeping before I introduce you to my powerful guests that are coming up in a few minutes. First of all, I want to again welcome you to Lenny Godfrey Straight, No Chaser. Remind you that you are on blogtalkradio.com/ S as in Sam, F as in Fred, T as in Tom, H as in Harry, and the number 2. And I say all of that because if you want to listen to back episodes, it is possible for you to listen to these episodes from, we've been on now over a year, so there are over 50 episodes that you can catch up on if you do, or just re-listen to some of your favorite people. And then if you press the number 1 after you've done, after you've gotten on Blog Talk Radio, you have the ability to, I'll see your hand up, and you have the ability to come on air, welcome the guest to the show, say hello, ask a question, whatever you'd like to do within the hour that we have. The hour goes quickly, and there are 2 people to ask a lot of questions. So therefore, it really is usually continued on our video portion, which is the after show afterthought, where we have them placed on Facebook and YouTube, and then you can see who you've been talking to for an hour. So now that I've done a bit of that housekeeping and getting all of that behind us, let me start the introductions to the 2 people that I have known for a long time in my adult life. These 2 people are respected thespians of the theater, television and film in one case. I will say Leon and Brenda Denmark I have known most of my adult life, even though probably Leon doesn't remember meeting me way back when Brenda was Brenda Thomas. And right before she became Brenda Denmark. But these 2 people I met, I'll start with Brenda, because I met Brenda in college, and we still will have to go over specifically what that first meeting was, because, you know, I have 3 or 4 different interpretations of my mind. But as we finished our college education, Brenda went on to do many Broadway productions. She was seen in Neil Simon's Proposal. She was in August Wilson's Joe Turner's Come and Gone. She's been a constant presence on theater, regional theater, Long Wharf. She's done Circle in the Circle Repertory Theater, the New Federal Theater. She's done films. She's been in the Law and Order, I think 6-9 episodes, SUVCI. And when you turn on the television, you see her or you hear her on some. And I am honored that she is a member of the ensemble that I am currently artistic director of, called Essence of Acting, and an active member of our planning committee and of our grant committee and many things. She is a businesswoman as well as an actor. She has a little rhythm to her. I don't say that she's a musical person all the way, but if you get her going, she can wiggle for you. So I've known my friend for a very long time, and I am so very, very honored to welcome Miss Brenda Thomas Denmark. Hello, Brenda, but you're going to have to be quiet because I have to talk about Leon now.
Well, okay.
All right. Hello, Brenda. Hello. And then there's Leon. Leon, I have to tell you, he's a mystery, Mr. Leon B. Denmark. He's a very quiet man. He is soft-spoken. He is an entrepreneur. He's a director. He is a man who of great educational records. He and my husband both have the degrees on the wall. You know, they scare you with so many things that they've done. But Leon, being a graduate of Columbia and going into the theater is one of the things that we want to talk about. He started on the SEEK program, and that's something that I had forgotten about was in existence a while ago, and is still in existence, and I want to talk about that. And then went on to be the general and managing director of the NEC, the Negro Ensemble Company, along with being its producing director. He then has made his presence known in the Newark Symphony Hall as their executive director, as the director, executive director of the Apollo Theater. He is vice president of programming at the New Jersey Performing Arts Center, and now he's executive director of Newark Performing Arts Center, along with his own business, and that he will go into if he chooses to. But these are two very, very busy people. I've had them on my calendar to try to get them on this program for weeks, and I would give a call, and everybody would be traveling one way or the other. So with all of that said, I welcome you, Mr. Denmark. I welcome you, Mrs. Denmark. Welcome.
Thank you.
And welcome
Thank
to
you.
Lenny Godfrey's Straight No Chaser. How are you all doing this evening?
Well, I'm trying to catch my breath after all that information you just gave out.
Well, that's a lot of information to disperse of, you know. We've been doing it for a little while. And I think that, and I said it off air before we started this whole program, that I think people don't realize the amount of energy and dedication that both of you have put into the varied things that you all have done. On my board just split in two. I'm telling you, you all got people listening. Thank you, everybody, for listening and coming in. People don't realize the effect that you have, that you all have had in our community, in the theater. How consistent you all have been, what role models that you are for us as thespians, as artists, as those of us in relationships to really look up to. And I thank you all for that. And so now I want to build this arc so people can understand by the radio, and then we'll go to the video, how you've built yourself. And so I'm going to ask both of you separately to think about this. And I'm going to start with Brenda. Brenda, I want you to go back to when you were little Brenda Thomas and where it all started, where that community, and for you it's full circle because you are kind of where you started in your life, and you can talk about that, and how that connection, at what point in your life did the arts make that connection to make you pay attention to the point where you are right now. So how did it all start for Brenda Thomas?
Well, you know, I guess like most of us who grew up in church, you know, we had to do recitations and had to get up on the stage and, you know, say whatever. So I guess it started with doing that. I took piano lessons. You know, I made the mistake of starting doodling at, you know, hitting the piano a little bit. My mother said, oh, she wants to learn the piano. She wants to get piano lessons. it was on to piano lessons. You know, I mean, a funny joke about it is I hated to practice. So yeah. I would, you know, if my mother would be out, I'm supposed to be practicing and I'm doing whatever and I'm checking the window to see if she's coming. As soon as I see her coming up the street, boom, on the piano, practicing. Oh, you've been practicing? Yes, Mommy, I've been practicing for about an hour now. Like, but you know the deal with that.
I very much know. So I know the deal, and I know all the conversations. Yes, I do.
Yes.
How long did you take? How long did you take piano?
I took piano for a long time. I took piano till I was probably like about 17.
Oh my
god. 18.
Well, this is something that
I took piano for a long time.
Yeah.
I was in a competition. My music teacher was at 409 Edgecombe Avenue, that building, that famous building there.
Yes.
That's where my music teacher was.
Yes.
And so I had gone in for national competitions and all of that, and, you know, did fine.
Well, now this is
I never
part
forget.
Of you I didn't know. I'm mm-hmm. a man. What were your pieces that you used to play? Do you remember?
Oh, Lord. No, God, that's too far back. But let me tell you a situation that did happen. So since I played the piano, right, they had me do a recital at the church.
Mm-hmm.
And I was playing. I did all my music. I did everything. And I think to my last piece. Now, I'm a person who don't like to make a mistake in front of people. Okay.
Yes,
I'm playing.
I know that about you.
And I messed up. And I messed up. Girl, I jumped up and ran off that stage crying. I couldn't handle
How
it.
How old were you? How old were you?
I was probably like about 12, 13.
Mm-hmm.
Probably around that age. So from early on, mistakes was not a part of my repertoire.
Huh.
Okay. Not in front of people.
Okay.
So
well, how
you
did
know,
you
do the piano?
Mm-hmm.
Now, the acting, there was a woman who I never forget her. Her name was Venezuela Jones. And she used to do dramatic readings and stuff. And she had pulled together myself and a few other kids to put together like a little theater group.
Mm-hmm.
So that's when I first did a play. Don't ask me the name, but I do not remember. I was trying to remember the name of the play. I couldn't remember. That was my first time doing a play. Then after that, you know, I didn't really dabble in that kind of thing because really when I went to college, I was going to college to be a social worker. That was what
that's
was
why
be.
That's why you weren't in there with us all the time. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Social work was my major. Sociology was my major and communications was my minor.
Mm-hmm.
I used to be in the class of Robert Kaya Hill.
Yes. Okay.
Right. Mm-hmm. You were in the class of Deloitte.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
So that's why. So
well,
that answers that question for you then, right?
Yes, you did. You answered that one. Thank you. Because I knew that,
yes.
But, and I remember, I do remember when Lloyd would suggest, he knew that at that point in time, there were not a lot of choices for young people of color to do theater, but he was determined to have theater done by the mm-hmm. few of us that were of color there. And so he told me to create something. And then I put out a flyer asking for people of color from different majors. And that's why that's how I met you all. You know, I always think that you all were in class with me, but I realized it was only a couple of us who were in class. Yes. Now,
I did do the Black Terror.
Yes.
At Hunter.
Yes.
I don't know if you mm-hmm. recall seeing that. I played Embolia.
Yes, I believe it. I
and
remember.
There was a sister named Polly who directed it. And I think Polly was in Lloyd's class.
Okay. I think she was in the directing class.
She was
in the directing class. Yeah.
Yeah.
See,
Trinidadian sister.
Along with the acting class. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because there was a lot of that going on because he had advanced acting class and he had a director's class. And so they had projects that they had to do. He would give me separate projects as an actor. But I want to go back. You skipped a little bit now because you can't. I can't let you skip. First of all, this is all New York City you're talking about, right? New York City, born and raised
in Harlem. In Harlem. Mother from St. Kitts, father from Trinidad.
Okay. Now, when you ran off that stage, that was the end of it for you for music? And then the transition happened for you as an actor because of Miss Van.
I still played the piano after that. No, I still played the piano after that. I continued with the piano, and then Miss Venezuela. Just stuff with her, and then moving along. You know, I was in school, college, so forth and so on, and then. I was a part of, I was connected with the last poet, the original Last Poets. Yeah, through David Nelson.
We were
friends. Yeah.
Okay.
And so that's, I was connected with them.
I hear Leon going. Go ahead.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was early on. Free Leon. And they had a place on 125th Street called the East Wind. So that's where National Black Theater started out, in the East Wind. And Barbara Antia came to Harlem, and she wanted to start a group. Judy Deering came up, and other people. And she wanted to start a theater group. And she, you know, spoke with the guy who ran it, really, was his name was Saint, I think, and Kane and Abby O'Doone and David. And Felipe was one of the original Last Poets also, Felipe Luciano.
Yes.
So she was using their space. And I started, I'll be honest with you, I started kind of like as therapy, you know, as a way of releasing. Yeah, because she did a lot of exercises and therapeutic. We had to go through the different cycles, the nigger cycle and the Negro cycle and all of this stuff. So I was all involved in that. And I guess that's where I really started getting more into theater and performing.
I want to stop you just short because I want to stop you short of when you met Leon, because I want you both to take me right up to that point, and then I want to find out how that join happened. So I'm going to stop you now where you're in theater now. Okay. So now, Leon, I'm going to go over to you. Now, where did it start? Where did you start from? How did you get from where you were? Are you a native New Yorker? Did you transport here? How did it all happen for you?
No, I was born in Frederick, Maryland, which is a
small town. Oh, Frederick, yes, I know. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's not so small now. It was the county seat back then. It's about 45 miles northeast of, equally from D.C. and Baltimore, actually. It's in the middle of a triangle. And so I was born there when Frederick was under official segregation. And I say that because that period of segregation, did a lot to shape my life and my path into the future. But I was born there. I was raised by my grandmothers. I had a grandma. Then I had a granny. Grandma was my great-great-grandmother. Granny, who was my principal parent, was my great-grandmother. And then there was Grandma Hazel. And then there was my mother. But I lived with my grandmothers until I was about 15 in Frederick, Maryland. And then I moved to live with my mother when I was 15 to place called York, Pennsylvania, which is not far from Frederick, right across the Mason-Dixon line. I graduated from William Penn Senior High School in York, Pennsylvania. At the time, every city in Pennsylvania had a William Penn Senior High School, you know. So I graduated from there, and I graduated in June And in September, I was on the bus to New York City.
Oh,
so that's how I got to New York City.
What happened before you go to the scholarship? What in that interim, in that time, drew you to New York? Why?
I did get a scholarship to a national. I was a national merit scholar, and I got a scholarship, and I could go to. I couldn't go to a black school. That was back in the days when they were emphasizing integration. So they said I couldn't go to a black school. And of course, having grown up in Maryland, Pennsylvania, I was always focused on Howard or Morgan or Cheney up in Pennsylvania, or Lincoln. But I couldn't go there. So I applied to and got accepted in the University of Chicago. I got accepted at the University of Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
Got accepted at Columbia University. So, and I had never been anywhere really. So I figured Chicago was too far away. So if I got in trouble, it would be hard to get home.
Mm-hmm.
Philadelphia, where University of Pennsylvania is too close. My mother would want me coming home every weekend, or she wanted to come visit me every weekend. New York was close enough that if I got in a problem, I could jump on the bus and come back.
Mm-hmm.
But it was far enough away that my mother wouldn't be insisting that I come home all the time. And literally, that's how I made the decision, you know, because I was the first person in my family to graduate from high school. I was the first person in my family to go to college. And going to college to me was not, I didn't know what that meant, really. Now, all through my high school and even junior high, I was a college prep student because I liked school. So they kept me in college prep. So I was prepared to go to college, but I didn't know what it meant. For example, at the end, when coming back from sophomore year, I came back late because I was thinking, well, you know, start September 3rd, but if I get there by the 8th, and I had a job, you know, at a factory back in York, Pennsylvania, so I wanted to finish that job and make a little more money. But I just didn't know what it meant to go to college.
Mm-hmm.
So I picked it like that. Now, fortunately, I had a choice between three very good schools.
Mm-hmm.
My choosing like that didn't detract from my future education.
You were blessed with making a great choice, even though you didn't realize how great a choice it would be for you.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think I would have done okay at University of Chicago or University of Pennsylvania, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I remember when I was in the 11th grade of high school in York, Pennsylvania, and, you know, I was like, I remember standing on the front porch saying, God, if you just let me get out of here, I promise you I'll be good. I promise you if you just let me get out of here. And if anybody's ever grown up in a small town, but you had big city in your pulse, you know what that feeling was.
Yes.
And sure enough, I was on that Greyhound bus in early September on the way to New York. And once I got off the bus at Port Authority, I stepped into the Port Authority and never looked back. I remember coming out. Going down and to get on the subway saying, yes, I could feel it. I could feel the pace. I could feel
it. You became an instant native New Yorker. That's what it is.
I was like, this is what I'm talking about. And
I know.
Had only been in town 10 minutes.
Now you've got your scholarship. What were you thinking that you were going to do, the major? What avenue were you seeking when you were going to Columbia?
I didn't have one really. Like I said, I didn't know anybody going to college, or I probably knew people. I just never had a back and forth with them, and nobody in my family had done that. So I did know I wanted to do good, you know, I wanted to do good, and I wanted to make sure I succeeded in the city.
Yes.
But I didn't have a major, you know, I didn't, you know, when I was in high school, I loved novels and reading. I wrote poetry, and I think I was published in the National Anthology of High School Poets and stuff. I know I was published in that. So I did that, and I was encouraged by my English teachers to write. So I had an affinity for writing and things like that. The only play I ever saw was a teleplay in the movie theater where Richard Burton was Hamlet. I remember it was an experimental Hamlet.
Mm-hmm.
I remember seeing that. And, of course, whatever mm-hmm. high school musicals they did.
Yeah.
But I've theater and all that. And it wasn't until later I got involved in the theater. And
well,
I didn't get into
you know,
theater because of theater, but that's another story.
Yes, I know. I'm going to get to that story because that's, you know, I mean, that's some meat there. You're in Columbia, and your resume and your history tells me that you have a strong business background, marketing, business. How did you fall into that?
Well, I fell into that actually through theater, but I think maybe the main motivation in those early times was, you know, I remember in 11th grade, in the library, because I used to go to the library and stay there until they put me out, I stumbled on this book called The Fire Next Time.
Mm-hmm.
It was by James Baldwin.
James Baldwin. Mm-hmm.
It's a short little essay called The Fire Next Time.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, it was all about things happening in Harlem. And I think there had been an early riot in Harlem. It was about that. And I was like, damn, you know, look what these guys are doing. Look what's going on. And even in high school, in 11th grade, I went on some civil rights protests and stuff like that, you know, marches in the high school. But I did have a sense of social justice and injustice. I did have a certain pride. I wouldn't have called it black pride, but those grandmothers I mentioned, they instilled in me, because they were mostly illiterate, but they were hardworking, and they were very proud ladies. They were domestics. That's the kind of work they did. But
mm-hmm.
They
mm-hmm.
held their head very high. And mm-hmm. they instilled in me a great sense of pride.
You sound like my husband. Tell me a little bit without getting you too emotional. Tell me a little bit about them, though. Were they born in that area?
Yeah, they were. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
They were my grandma. She was her mother was a Native American, but
uh-huh.
grandma was a very dark skinned lady. She was. What back in those days they called her. She was coal back.
Okay.
But
mm-hmm.
she's very statuesque and very regal lady.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Granny, who's grandma's daughter, she and her twin sister, Aunt Carrie, they were so fair skinned that they could pass for white. And
wow.
I never figured out how that happened. And they never told that story to me. But they were so fair-skinned that they could pass for white. In fact, Aunt Carrie married a white man, actually.
Okay.
And got away with that because they didn't live together, actually.
Okay.
He was a merchant marine, so he wasn't
right.
around that much.
Much, yes.
Say all that to say that somewhere in their experience, Granny, who raised me mostly, we weren't really wealthy. Aunt Carrie was kind of well off. Her husband was a merchant marine. So, but we all lived in the what was then the projects, and Aunt Carrie had carpet on her floor, but Granny had linoleum on her floor. So all of that led to them teaching me, and then I was my color, which was dark. So all of them teaching me a pride in being, in quotes, a Negro, and Granny teaching me do not pride in whoever you are, whether you have money or not. And then teaching me, all three of them teaching, or Granny and Grandma teaching me and my mother, the value of hard work. So I brought all of that to Columbia, actually. I brought all of that to Columbia. That was a driving force for me. The value of hard work, a pride in being, again, a Negro and being black, and not no sense of someone being better than me.
Yes.
All right. So so because of that, I was a hard worker, and I was always focused on getting things done. So whenever I got into a group endeavor, and after you know how people are when they get into a group, Lenny, they talk and talk and talk and talk. If we're going to do this, we should do that. And I would finally say, okay, hold it. Now, how are we going to get this done? What's the first step? And I would almost invariably be the one who started to put the talk and the ideas into motion.
Into motion.
And that's how I got involved in administration. And then once you do that, then you got to, well, how are you going to pay for this? And, you know, do you have enough money? And that's how I started to develop a sense of business, because I always was focused on getting things done.
Well, how did – now, you know, now I'm going to say this. You're not going to believe it. We are past halfway done. We only have about 20 minutes left. Okay. I told you it goes fast. Okay. So now I gotta push you both together a little bit faster now to get to how did the arts come into, I can see how it got into Brenda, because that there was that legacy of family and parents always wanting you to have as many tools at your disposal as possible. You, though, came from a whole nother venue, but then eventually, once you got out of Columbia, I can see you started with this program, and I do want you to tell people what that was because it's so significant to who you are now and what things are and how that led to you getting into the arts and eventually somehow meeting Brenda. So somebody better tell me something.
Well, I actually got into the theater while I was at Columbia.
Okay.
So Columbia is at the top of Morningside Heights, right above Harlem. And I was always back and forth in Harlem. And I was into social justice. So I actually worked with the West Harlem Tenants Association and things like that. And in 60, whatever, I won't mention the year, but we worked to bring a contingent out of Harlem to protest the Vietnam War at the UN. And so I was involved in Harlem a lot. And I went to classes with Professor Clark and, I went to Michaud's bookstore and those kind of things. So, so after the student protest at Columbia, the black student protest and student protest in general at Columbia in 68, of which I played a big part in that. After that, my roommate and I, we lived on 141st and Riverside. We said, well, we want to get involved in something in Harlem. He was a writer, musician, and he says, well, we in Harlem called the New Lafayette Theater. Let's go see if we can get involved in that. And I remember going up to the Lafayette, which was 130-something and 7th Avenue. This is after the first one had burnt down, and they moved up the up the street. Bob Macbeth, who was the director, said, sure, you guys, We're starting a second company called the Black Theater Workshop. You guys can work in that. So, and that was on 112th and Lenox, and they had a nice little theater there they had built. So I got involved in that. We had acting classes, and then we eventually did some plays. The first play we did was by a woman, a playwright, Marty Childs, who was, her mother was in the company of New Lafayette. So I got involved in that. And once again, I did take an acting class, actually, at the workshop. Bill Dukes actually ran the acting class. He was fresh out of New York NYU theater program where he went. But he directed the acting class. But we went to do some plays. Bill Lathan was a director, and Roscoe Orman directed one of the plays. And I wasn't really much of an actor, so I said, okay, I'll be the house manager, and, you know, and it started from there. I was the house manager. And then that, you know, that broke up, and we started our own theater company called the Black Magicians. We worked out of a place called the Third World in the Bronx. We did a lot of street theater. Ben Caldwell ran the Third World place in the Bronx, and again, I was the guy who did the organizing, the house management, and helping to sell the tickets and all that kind of stuff. So, I did all of that while I was in college, actually. And in between there, after the Columbia protest, I had to get a job, and one of the jobs I got was over at Teachers College, and it was a program called the Collegiate Compensatory Program. It was studying programs that help Black students get into college, and the secretary there was Brenda. The secretary was Brenda, and when I first met her, I think she was still going with she was still going with David Nelson at the last course. I remember meeting her with David Nelson. But she worked as a secretary in that program.
I see. So now, Brenda. I'm trying to get, you know, I'm trying to create this arc. I'm not going to have enough time today, I can tell you right now, because we only have about 20 minutes left, but that's okay. So you went there, you met her, she was there. Brenda, you were there working because your degree then was in sociology. Did that take you there?
Well, I was working there, but I was still. See, first I went to Bronx Community College. I graduated from Bronx Community. Then I took a little minor break. Then I started at Hunter. But I was started off at Hunter kind of part time. So I was also working, and I was a friend of ours got me the job working at the Collegiate Compensatory Program, and yes, Leon did come up there because it was funny. I saw him in the street on Amsterdam Avenue because this place was located up there, Teachers College, and the office was in an apartment building on 121st Street, and I was walking on Amsterdam Avenue, and I saw Leon, and he saw me, and our heads swung around. And I looked, and I turned back around, and I went upstairs, and I told my good friend, James McGinnis, who's one of my best friends, I said, I saw the guy. I saw him. I saw him. But I had told him about Leon. I haven't met Leon before. I saw him. And then he came up to the office for a job. It was meant to be. It was meant to be. It was in the stars.
Well, I guess it was. And you all.
It was in the stars.
You know, I mean, what I get is that even though, you know, there was no purposeful arts thing, the arts just kind of drew you all together, which is it's unbelievable that, you come from so many the different worlds. But there's that common thing that got you there, and I mean it's very uncommon. I mean I from looking with what your background was when you talk about it, Leon, I wouldn't think that that's where you would have, you know, focused yourself. I mm-hmm. thought, well, okay, he's going to come to New York mm-hmm. and he's going to probably get a degree in something else and work in an office and blah, 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 because he just wants mm-hmm. to get out and he wants to experience that New York thing. But mm-hmm. the desire of the arts that you all did, well, okay, all right. So now I've got
well,
you all.
You see, Lenny, let me say, what I spotted right away when I went to the New Lafayette was that the theater was a way for us to start to project ourselves as full human beings, that is us being mm-hmm. black people. Because mm-hmm. all that upbringing about being proud of yourself, but having to do that in the face of official segregation, that was with me. And here mm-hmm. here was the theater. Don't forget, back in those days, there were very few images of black people, full-blooded black people in the
yes.
public eye. And here,
exactly.
all of a sudden, going mm-hmm. into the New Lafayette and all the characters that Ed Bolins had written mm-hmm. in those plays,
yep.
mm-hmm. all of a sudden, there was my uncle, there was my cousin, there was my mm-hmm. grandmother up there on that
there
stage.
There were people
and,
that you could, and, exactly. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Speaking
mm-hmm.
universal truths.
Yeah.
That,
it, you know, it wasn't,
that I didn't have to read the Greek classics or Shakespeare, all of which I had read, but
yes.
here was the guys in Going to Buffalo, and I was thinking, oh, I know a guy like that.
Exactly.
You know, but he was saying exactly. something going, I said, oh, yeah. So okay. that drew me to the theater.
All
that
right,
drew
now.
Me to the theater. And all of a sudden, I had a purpose and a way of pursuing that purpose.
This is fascinating because, of course, now I need a whole another half hour to talk about what where it takes you now. But but there's a question. So someone has raised their hand and they want to ask you all a question. So I have to let that supersede where I want to go. Let's welcome them to the show and let's find out what information they need from you. I want to thank you. Welcome to Lenny Godfrey Straight No Chaser. If you can give us your first name and where you're calling from. Welcome.
Hello. My name is Julius. And I just...
I never recognized this number. Go ahead.
I wanted to talk to the Duke and Duchess Denmark. I know you're deeply rooted in the theater. So I just, Leon, where do you think theater is going in the future?
Well, you know, I it's hard. Theater has all, and it depends on what you mean by theater, but theater in general, there's a more of an emphasis now on the commerciality of theater, and that's a good thing. You know, people have to make a living, so I think it will continue to go in that direction. That the whether or not piece of theater can make money becomes the primary motivation for doing the theater. Not to say let me say this. Artists tend to, especially writers, they tend to write to the way that they can get their play done.
Mm-hmm.
And if the way of getting their play done is that they need to consider the commercial viability of it, then they will write to that,
mm-hmm.
you know. Now, not all artists do that. I don't mean to make a blanket statement like that. That's the direction in which theater will go, which will also mean there will be more and more revivals, but there have always been revivals. And the primary reason for revivals is that it's a proven work and it will probably sell tickets. And it's also
mm-hmm.
becomes a vehicle for someone who's a proven artist who will probably sell tickets. So that creates a lot of good theater, and it has in the past, and I'm sure it will continue. I wish, though, that Black Theater had at its disposal a theater company run by people who, when they wake up, the only thing they're thinking about is what black play will we work on today. And unfortunately, in America, now, don't get me wrong, there's a lot of small theaters, local theaters, in which that happens. So I'm not putting them down. But what I mean is a theater that is automatically on the national scene, like the Negro Ensemble was in its heyday, that's automatically on the national scene, where it's run by somebody who, when they wake up, the thing they're thinking about is what black play will I put on, will I work on today? That was a phenomenon that existed from the mid-60s to the end of the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
Except the only there are a couple exceptions, like the New Federal Theater, don't get me wrong. A couple of New Federal Theater is still doing that, but it doesn't have the impact that it used to have. And so I wish there was a theater that had that impact and run in that way. I don't think that theater will be around anytime soon. But in the meantime, one of the things that has occurred because of the work that happened from mid-60s to the end of the 80s is that black actors, black writers, black directors, their humanity and their ability to create universal culture has, I think, now been fairly well established, although it's still fought at every turn by the so-called dominant culture. But it's fairly well established, and it will continue, I'm sure, to make inroads, especially into the cultural, the commercial cultural world, because it has been fairly well established. It cannot be controlled by the predominant culture in America like it used to be. It now has an international audience, and that international audience is hungry for it. So I hope that begins to answer your question, Julius.
I think also, let me add a little bit to it. I've muted Julius already because, see, I'm not going to let Julius get back on here because y'all will be laughing all for 15 minutes.
Okay.
I think that there also is an idea of a hybrid of theater that there's an idea that there's hopefully in the making a theater that does think about when you go to bed, when you wake up, doing theater for, again, theater's sake, but we all know that everyone has to make a living. There was a time when you got into theater, you weren't thinking about getting into theater and making six figures in theater or television or film. That those opportunities weren't there. So the opportunities are here, and I think that they can be fostered, that a theater company can be supported by the other arts to be so it's not so dependent upon the commercial aspect of it and more of the content aspect of it. And be it black theater, be it white theater, be it Latino theater, that the theater in general is something that we hope when someone gets up in the morning, that's what they're thinking about. And maybe that's a hybrid that can come out of one of the many things that we are working toward as artists in this society. So let's keep that in a prayer, I would say.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Let's keep that in a prayer. In this last 7 minutes that we have, I told you it would go fast. And Leon?
Yes, you did.
Leon,
yes, ma'am.
I have known you for many years. This is the first time I've ever heard you talk that much. Do you know that?
Oh, I can talk, girl.
Yeah, he can talk.
I know, well, but I have I've never been privy to it. I see him, I hug him, I kiss him, and I'm going, and I used to say, well, he's the most quiet person in the world. I just think he's a great storyteller. I have to tell you now, I'm sick of you. You will never be in my presence again and only say one word or two. You are, that's done.
Oh, boy.
That is done. But when I'm in the vein of what Julius was asking in the last few minutes that we have, and this is for both of you. You both are involved in the arts. You all also involved in other businesses. What footprint do you want to leave? You have children. You are now some grandparents. What footprint do you want to leave?
Go ahead, Bryn.
You better say
oh,
that.
Oh, my goodness. Wow. Well, you know what? I'm going to take it onto the business side because, yes, you said we do have a business. And I'm not going to go into what the business is. I'm just going to say it's financial services and educating people about money. Mm-hmm. And we are very focused on our people having an awareness of finances
mm-hmm.
so that we can build a legacy
mm-hmm.
for our children and
mm-hmm.
our children's children.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I often say, you know, the grandchildren and great-grandchildren of Rockefeller, they know who he was.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Our great-grandchildren, mm-hmm. we want to make sure our children and great-grandchildren know who we were.
Yeah.
We want to build a legacy for our children, so that they don't have, so they have a leg up. So they have a leg up. You know,
yeah.
we have a house here, and I had a tenant who, it was a young white couple. They're very nice. They were both in theater. And their parents had an endowment for them.
Mm-hmm.
I had never heard of that. I mean, I was like, what?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Because they were able, if they were doing a show or whatever, and they couldn't handle whatever, but it was there for them. They were being taken care of. Their parents are helping foster their dreams for them.
Yeah. Yeah.
Helping them to move forward.
We don't
have that. We don't even think about that.
Well, we're beginning to because you have businesses like yours. Yes. Because I think that the passion that happens in this society is because people do think about the future of their children. You know, they're very passionate about, you know, what's going to happen with their children, the rights of their children, not being abused, not being taken away. And equally, we have to be as concerned about that as everyone else is. And I think that is becoming in the forefront. A concern and a footprint that can help people identify, you know, and give an equity
and
it evens out the playing for everyone.
I love being a part of. I'm going to give a plug now to Essence of Acting because what we're doing is the part of Essence of Acting is to put those stories out there. To put that message out, give that history, give some of that history information, and put that story out there. And same way Leon knew all of, you know, the stuff because he's big into history. If you get it, if when next time he comes to your house, just bring up history, some history stuff, and you won't be able to move.
Okay.
I'm telling you, you should be careful what you ask for now. I'm telling you.
I understand. Well, you know, it's one of the things, you know, one of the things that we want to do is to create opportunities across the board in theater, especially in the EOA, so that people who write plays, no matter who they write the plays for, that they consider that everybody can do their plays.
Mm-hmm.
And you were involved in a play
that
was not written. You know, we just did a reading of a play that was not written for people of color, but now the playwright doesn't think about his piece without people of color doing it, you know.
Exactly.
So, you know, it's one of those things.
Because
it's
universal stories.
Yes,
they're universal stories.
Exactly. All right, now you have to be quiet because I have to get to Leon, and I only have two and a half minutes. Leon.
Oh.
Uh huh. Yeah.
Footprint. Uh huh. Footprint. Uh huh.
Well, I mean, I feel as though I've already left some footprints in theater. You know, with working the opportunity to work with Douglas Stern Award at the Negro Ensemble Company was a once in a lifetime opportunity. So, and helping him realize some of his work that I have a footprint there with, Home and Neva's Mountain Dew and Zoo Man and the Sign. And then a soldier's play, in the theater, as in many things, if your name is in a book, then you're part of the history. So
yes.
I got my name in several books and Samuel printed versions. So I've done that, and I'm proud of the fact that I helped. I always say to myself, the whole time I was at the NEC, I never missed a payroll. I was there for 11 years, and for 11 years, every Thursday, we had to make the payroll. So we never missed the payroll, and while I was there anyway. And I'm happy to have been able to do that. I mean, that's a relatively small thing. But at the time, it could be a very big thing.
It's a very big thing to those
people had to get
payroll.
Paid.
Believe me, it's a very important thing. Well,
very important.
I've done that, and I as we go forward, like Brenda, I would like to somehow or another encourage the development of at least a discussion about Black people supporting the not-for-profit version of the arts. The commercial arts are great. People can build fortunes and build fame. But if you notice, in the mainstream culture, right up under it, often art.
Yep.
Because that's where the talent is discovered and developed to its utmost.
Exactly.
So that when it hits the commercial stream, it's been honed.
There's a better chance for success.
Control of
mm-hmm.
I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm.
Until we get control of that, then we won't get total control of our own cultural destiny as it's expressed through the arts.
Agreed. Until we tell our own stories. We have to tell our stories.
Telling your story is not just getting it done. It's telling your story begins with who chooses this story.
Exactly.
Most Black artists in America have never been in a position of having a Black person choose the story.
Exactly.
Did I talk too much?
No, I'm just going to say this because I only have a few more minutes and I have to do the promo for next week. But what I've learned is that it's people talk about being in the room. You not only have to be in the room, 90 seconds. You don't have to be in the room. You have to be at the table. You know, active at the table is what you have to do. Now, I will say to you, thank you both very much. We will continue this on our video, on the After Show Afterthoughts. Next week, I'm going to have two wonderful women who are part of the theater, Mary Miko and Laura Yeager. They are in a wonderful group called the League of Professional Theater Women. They're going to come in and talk about the theater with me. And we're going to continue this, but at this, I thank you all so very much for listening to Lenny Godfrey Straight No Chaser, and I'll see you next week at this time. I'll see you all in a few minutes now. Thank you.
This is something we all know. Fever isn't such a new thing. Fever started long ago. Never know how much I love you. You never know how much I care. When you put your arms around me, I get a feeling that's too hard to bear.